Welcome back to another episode of Melody Mind. Today, we're taking you to a place where the rain is almost as famous as the music, Seattle, early 1990s. Picture this: wet streets, a gray sky, and somewhere down the block, from a tiny club, that raw, unpolished sound spilling into the night. A sound that was about to change the world.
Oh yes, and what a sound it was. Heavy, melancholic, but at the same time so powerful. It felt like every note was born out of bottled-up anger and deep vulnerability. And right in the middle of all that noise, there were women on stage who weren't just keeping up. They were carving out their own, unmistakable space.
You know what struck me instantly back then? That mix of fragility and strength. With some of these artists, you had the feeling they could see straight through you and then, with their voice, say everything you never dared to put into words yourself.
Yeah, and it wasn't just music. It was an attitude, almost a protest movement, against glossy pop, against polished images, against a system where women were often treated as decoration rather than creators.
Exactly. And the vibe in those clubs? You'd be in a room that maybe held 100 people at most. Sticky floors, humid air, flat beer. Then the lights would drop, and a woman with a beaten-up Fender bass would step forward. No big intro, no, hey, how's everybody doing? Just a quick glance, and then a thunderous bassline shaking the walls.
I remember my first time experiencing something like that. It wasn't in Seattle. It was in a little club in San Francisco. A touring band from the scene was playing, and the front woman, she didn't just scream into the mic. She let her voice roll over you like a wave. I stood there, completely stunned, and I knew, this is new. This is something I won't shake off.
And it was raw.
Extremely
raw. The guitars had that muddy, almost overdriven wall of sound, not meant to be perfect. No glossy sheen, no gimmicks. It was all about honesty, about the courage to not be perfect.
And that inspired so many women to pick up a guitar themselves. Because suddenly you could see, you don't need a flawless image. You don't need to be a pop diva. You can pour your anger, your doubts, your frustration, all of it straight into your song.
And somehow, or maybe because of that, it was so powerful. I remember one gig where it was pouring outside. We were drenched, the sound was deafening, and then the band started a song so quietly you could hear people holding their breath. And then, boom, the chorus hit like an earthquake. I swear the whole room shook.
That dynamic was one of the hallmarks of grunge, the ability to move within a song from fragile intimacy to explosive rage. And many of the women in the scene did it with an emotional depth that went straight to the bone.
And it was more than music. It was a statement against the rules of the industry, against what women were supposed to be. Many of them just said, forget that, we'll do it our way.
And that's exactly why it was so important to see them up there. Because their presence on stage meant you can be loud, you can be uncomfortable, you can refuse to fit into a box.
That's probably one of the reasons why female grunge still resonates so strongly today. Even if the peak is long gone, you can feel that spirit in countless modern bands. And I think that's where we should start, with those first moments when women in grunge began to find their own voice.
Yeah, and to really understand that, we've got to look at how it all began, who those first women were, how they found their way into the scene, and how they managed, among all those loud, rough male voices, not only to keep up, but to create something unmistakably their own.
So, before the world knew the word grunge, before the plaid shirts hit the fashion magazines, there was this underground scene bubbling away in Seattle's backyards, basements, and grimy rehearsal spaces. And women were already there, laying the foundation?
Exactly. People sometimes imagine grunge started the moment Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit hit the airwaves in 91. But the reality is, it was years in the making. And a lot of the DNA came from women who were blending punk's raw energy with something darker, slower, and more emotionally charged.
Yeah, like in the late 80s, you'd have these shows where half the audience knew each other by name. You'd walk into a club like the Central Tavern or the Vogue, and there'd be a handful of people swapping homemade cassette demos. And somewhere on that stage, a woman with a guitar that looked like it had survived a war.
One of the earliest bands I remember hearing about was the Gits. Mia Zapata was just She had that presence, you know. She could sing something heartbreakingly tender and then rip into a snarling, almost punk growl the next moment. The Gits weren't technically grunge in the commercial sense, but they were part of that same family tree. Gritty, real, and fearless.
And Mia's lyrics, man, they didn't hold back. She sang about street life, about pain, about survival. And that's something that bled into the whole grunge ethos, telling the truth, even if it was messy, even if it made people uncomfortable.
And then you had someone like Kat Bjelland with Babes in Toyland, okay? Technically, they were Minneapolis-based. But their influence reached Seattle hard. Kat had this mix of childlike aesthetic and volcanic rage that broke every mold. She showed you could be visually playful, but sonically brutal. And that gave a lot of other women permission to embrace contradiction.
That's true. And then there were bands like 7 Year Bitch. Their debut in the early 90s came from years of grinding it out in the underground. They had this fierce, unapologetic punk grunge hybrid sound. And they were openly political, calling out sexism, abuse, and violence in ways that made some people uncomfortable. But that was the point.
It's important to remember how DIY this all was. We're talking small, independent labels like CZ Records and Kill Rock Stars. You didn't just get signed. You traded tapes. You called up college radio stations. You stapled your own gig flyers to telephone poles. There was a network of zines, house shows, and borrowed vans that kept everything alive.
And that's where community really mattered. These women weren't isolated. They were part of a web. You'd see the same faces at different shows. Sometimes in the audience, sometimes behind the merch table, and sometimes jumping up on stage to fill in for another band. It was fluid, messy, and incredibly creative.
And that cross-pollination was huge. Like you might have a drummer from one band stepping in for another, or a guitarist lending riffs to a friend's track. And because there was this sense of us against the mainstream, women supported each other in ways you didn't always see in more competitive, male-dominated scenes.
Another thing people forget, this scene didn't have much money. Gear was beaten up, studios were makeshift. A lot of early recordings were done on borrowed 4-tracks or in tiny basement setups. But somehow, that lo-fi grit became part of the sound's DNA.
Yeah, and women adapted to that too. I remember hearing a story about one singer whose amp broke mid-show, and instead of stopping, she just plugged directly into the PA. It sounded raw, distorted, and somehow better. That kind of improvisation wasn't rare. It was survival.
And let's not forget the Riot Girl RL connection. Even though that movement really took off in Olympia, just an hour south of Seattle, it bled into the grunge world. Bands like Bikini Kill were carrying feminist manifestos into punk and alternative spaces. And that energy gave more women in grunge the language to talk about what they were already living through.
Right. And it wasn't just about gender politics. It was about owning your narrative. Female grunge artists weren't waiting for permission to be seen as songwriters or bandleaders. They were taking the mic, writing the lyrics, arranging the songs. And that agency was revolutionary in a rock world, still very male-centered.
I think that's why those early days feel so special in hindsight. There was no blueprint. No one was thinking, we're going to start a genre and get famous. They were just making noise with friends, chasing that rush you get when the right chord progression hits at the right moment. And somehow out of that chaos, a movement formed, one where women had a seat at the table from the start.
And we'll get to the big names soon, but I think it's important to remember these roots, because without that messy, passionate, underground foundation, the explosion of grunge in the early 90s and the visibility of women within it might never have happened.
So as the 80s bled into the 90s, something started shifting. Those small, sweaty basement gigs and hole-in-the-wall venues began to spill over into slightly bigger stages. And suddenly, you'd see female-fronted bands, not just on local bills, but opening for touring acts from out of state.
Yeah, and that was huge. I remember reading a little blurb in a local zine about a Seattle band playing a show in Portland. And the writer said they blew the headliner off the stage. It wasn't about gender in that sentence. It was about pure performance power. And that's when you knew something was breaking open.
Exactly. Take a band like 7 Year Bitch. Before they got national attention, they were already building this reputation up and down the West Coast. They'd show up in towns where nobody knew their name. And by the end of the set, people were screaming for an encore. That's the kind of grassroots grind that most bands today never experience because everything's online.
And speaking of online, back then there was none of that. If you wanted people to hear your music, you handed them a cassette. You mailed out promo copies to college radio stations. You prayed the DJ on the 1 a.m. slot would spin your track. And for women in grunge, getting that airtime often meant pushing twice as hard.
Yeah, because the bias was real. A lot of station managers didn't think their listeners wanted to hear women screaming over distorted guitars. But the thing is, the audience absolutely did. They just didn't know it yet. And when they heard it, it clicked.
It clicked because it was raw, relatable, and cathartic. You didn't have to be part of the Seattle scene to feel it. The emotions were universal. And once a few bands managed to get out of town and hit the road, that energy started to spread like wildfire.
I remember talking to someone who caught L7 on one of their early tours. Again, not strictly a Seattle band, but deeply tied into that same ethos. He said the sheer volume of their set rattled his ribcage, and that the band's attitude was just unapologetic. No pandering, no softening the edges for anyone.
And that unapologetic stance was contagious. Bands saw that you didn't have to tone it down to reach people. In fact, the opposite was true. The more you leaned into the chaos, the more people respected it. That's something a lot of female artists learned watching each other on stage in those years.
And then came the first taste of real press coverage. I'm talking about features in underground music magazines, the occasional mention in Rolling Stone's back pages, or a live review in the Seattle Weekly. Suddenly, female-fronted grunge bands weren't just a local phenomenon. They were part of a narrative about the next big thing.
Of course, that came with mixed feelings. On one hand, exposure meant more people heard your music. On the other hand, it meant the mainstream press started labeling you, boxing you in. Some called these women angry girls with guitars, like it was a novelty, rather than acknowledging them as skilled musicians and songwriters.
And yet, they kept pushing forward. Because for every lazy stereotype in the press, there were 100 kids showing up to gigs, feeling seen for the first time, especially young women in the crowd. They'd watch someone like Mia Zapata or Celine Vigil Wilk and think, I can do that. I can own that stage.
Yeah, and you'd see it ripple outward. By 90 or 91, you started to notice more women in the front rows at shows, more of them starting bands of their own. And that's a legacy we sometimes overlook. The way these early pioneers didn't just play music, they shifted who felt welcome in those spaces.
And the labels, the indie ones, anyway, were starting to take notice. Sub Pop gets most of the credit for the grunge boom, but there were others like CZ and Kill Rock Stars actively signing or promoting women-led bands. It wasn't charity. It was because the music was undeniable.
Still, even with a label behind you, the grind was relentless. These women were hauling gear, driving vans overnight, playing to 20 people in some towns. And then, a week later, they'd be in a packed venue in San Diego, with kids singing their lyrics back to them. It was unpredictable and exhausting. But it built resilience.
That resilience was essential, because the industry wasn't rolling out the red carpet. Even when grunge started blowing up, women had to fight for equal billing on festival lineups or for decent soundcheck times. And yet, they still got up there and delivered night after night.
And maybe that's why their performances had so much bite. There was this undercurrent of, we earned this stage and we're going to burn it down before we give it back. You could feel that energy in the room. It wasn't just entertainment, it was a declaration.
And by the time the early 90s rolled around, those declarations were getting louder, and the rest of the world was starting to listen. The seeds planted in those basements and dive bars were about to explode into something no one could ignore.
Yeah, and in the next part of the story, we'll see exactly how that explosion happened, and how women made sure their voices were part of the blast.
By the time 1991 rolled around, you could feel the tension in the air. Seattle wasn't just a local scene anymore. It was a headline, And for the women who had been there from the start, it was a strange mix of excitement and caution.
Right. Suddenly, major label reps, who wouldn't have touched a noisy, sweaty club gig a year earlier, were flying in from LA and New York. They'd stand at the back of the room in expensive coats, scribbling in notebooks, pretending not to look too interested. But everyone knew what they were there for.
And here's the thing. Some bands were ready to take that leap. Others weren't so sure. For a lot of the women in the scene, the fear was that a label deal might mean losing control. Someone telling you to soften your sound, change your look, or appeal to a wider audience.
And those fears weren't unfounded. I heard about one A&R guy who actually told a front woman, "We love your songs, but could you try dressing more feminine on stage?" She laughed in his face and walked out. That was the kind of backbone that kept the scene authentic, even as the big money started circling.
But there were also strategic moves. Some bands thought, if we can get a bigger budget, we can tour more, record better, reach more people. And for a few, that gamble paid off. They got distribution, radio play, and suddenly they were on the same festival posters as the big grunge names everyone recognizes today.
And let's not forget, MTV was starting to sniff around. They wanted authentic grunge content, but their definition of authentic sometimes looked suspiciously like whatever sold well. Still, getting a video into rotation could change a band's life overnight. The catch was making a video that didn't betray what you stood for.
Exactly. And some of those early videos from female-fronted bands were intentionally raw, no glossy lighting, no choreographed nonsense, just the band playing in a dingy warehouse or intercut with grainy tour footage. It was a way of saying, we'll take your airtime, but we're not playing your game.
I think about L7's Pretend We're Dead, not Seattle-based, but still part of that same cultural moment. It was catchy enough for mainstream audiences, but it didn't dilute their identity. And that showed other women in the scene that you could step into the spotlight without losing yourself.
Meanwhile, on the ground, the touring circuit was heating up. Women-led bands were getting invited to open for some of the rising grunge giants. That meant bigger crowds, but also more pressure. You were playing to thousands of people who might have never heard of you before, and you had about 30 minutes to win them over.
And a lot of them did. I remember hearing about a show where a female-fronted band opened for Soundgarden and ended up selling out their own headlining gig in the same city just weeks later. Word of mouth was everything back then. And if you killed it live, people remembered.
But not everyone was comfortable with the mainstream spotlight. Some bands deliberately stayed with indie labels, even when the big ones came calling. For them, it wasn't about making it. It was about keeping the music pure, keeping it in the hands of the community that built it.
And honestly, that tension between wanting to grow and wanting to stay underground is part of what gave female grunge its edge. These women were navigating uncharted territory. They were in a genre that wasn't supposed to care about fame, but fame was suddenly knocking on the door.
And the door didn't just open, it got kicked in when Nirvana blew up in 91. Overnight, the press was obsessed with Seattle, and suddenly every label wanted the next big grunge act. That wave pulled a lot of bands along with it, including women who had been grinding for years without much recognition.
It was a blessing and a curse. On one hand, more ears on the music, more opportunities. On the other hand, the media started treating grunge like a fad, and that meant they wanted to fit everyone into neat little packages. That's when you started seeing the same lazy comparisons and female Cobain headlines that missed the point entirely.
But through all of that, the authenticity shone through. Because no matter how big the venues got or how many interviews they did, these women still played like it was a basement show for 40 people. That intimacy, that defiance, was impossible to fake.
And as we step into the next chapter, that's the moment we're looking at. When female grunge artists went from being the underground's best kept secret to standing shoulder to shoulder with the genre's biggest names, all while fighting to keep their voices from being drowned out by the noise of the machine.
So now that we've talked about how these women fought their way into the scene, we should talk about the actual sound they were creating, because female grunge wasn't just a carbon copy of what the guys were doing. It had its own identity.
Absolutely. People sometimes forget that grunge was never one uniform sound. It was a messy spectrum. and the women in the scene added layers that were sometimes overlooked, from complex vocal harmonies to unconventional song structures.
And the guitar work, we've got to talk about that. Sure, there were the trademark, heavy, overdriven riffs in Drop D, but listen to someone like Kat Bjelland or Jennifer Finch, they weren't afraid to mix a jagged, punk-style strum with big, sludgy grunge chords. It made the songs unpredictable in the best way.
Yeah, and the tones themselves. This wasn't about pristine, crystal-clear guitar sounds. It was about texture. Layers of fuzz, distortion that sounded like it was about to implode. And amps pushed so hard you could hear the speaker strain. And for a lot of women, that texture became a way of expressing something rawer than words could.
And then there were the vocals. I mean, some of the most powerful grunge moments came from voices that could switch from a whisper to a scream in a heartbeat. Mia Zapata had that soulful grit. Donita Sparks from L7 could go from sarcastic drawl to full-throttle roar. Kat Bjelland could sound like she was channeling a whole storm through her lungs.
Right, and the contrast was everything, because in the middle of a set, you'd have a moment where the guitars dropped out, and it was just a single voice over a minimal bass line, and it would pull the whole crowd in. And then, without warning, the band would crash back in, twice as loud. That push and pull was addictive.
And it wasn't just dynamics, it was the way songs were built. These women didn't feel tied to the verse-chorus-verse formula. Some tracks were sprawling, with bridges that went off into completely different moods before looping back. Others ended abruptly, almost daring the listener to want more.
And lyrically, that's where a lot of the revolution happened. Women in grunge wrote about everything from personal trauma to absurd humor to biting social commentary. And they did it without sugarcoating. Songs could be brutally honest about assault, sexism, grief, or mental health, and then follow up with a track full of biting satire.
Yeah, and the honesty was part of the power. There was no hiding behind metaphors if you didn't want to. You could be as direct as you felt. And that was liberating, especially in a rock scene that often wanted women to write pretty lyrics about safe topics.
Let's not forget the rhythm section either. A lot of these bands had bass lines that were just as prominent as the guitars, sometimes even more so. And the drumming, fierce, heavy, unafraid to sit in the pocket for minutes at a time before exploding into chaos. Lori Barbero from Babes in Toyland, for example, she played like she was wrestling the kit into submission.
And that's another thing, the interplay between instruments. Because in female-fronted grunge, you'd often hear bass and drums locking into this hypnotic groove, with the guitar adding tension, rather than just driving the chords. It gave the music a different shape, less predictable, more primal.
And then there's the production side. Most early grunge records, especially from women-led bands, weren't recorded in big studios. You'd get sessions in small, homegrown spots, with just enough gear to get the job done. But that minimalism forced creativity. If you couldn't afford a fancy effect pedal, you'd tape the mic to a chair, run it through a broken amp, and make your own sound.
And those limitations became part of the signature. You can hear it. That slightly off-kilter snare sound, the way the vocals sometimes distort when they hit a scream, the rough edges on the guitar tracks. Today, producers spend hours trying to recreate that kind of imperfection. Back then, it was just reality.
I think that's why these records still hit so hard. You listen to them now, and you feel like you're in the room. Sweat in the air, amps buzzing, someone knocking over a beer in the crowd. There's no digital sheen to create distance. It's immediate.
And it's not nostalgia. It's that the music was built for connection, not perfection. That's a big reason why female grunge still inspires new artists today. They hear that freedom and think, I can do that. I don't have to sound like everyone else.
And it's not just about copying the old sound. It's about taking the spirit of it. The way those women bent the rules, challenged expectations, and made space for themselves musically, that's the real revolution.
So let's talk about the actual milestones, those songs and albums that didn't just make waves in the grunge scene, but redefined what women could sound like in rock.
Yeah, and I think we have to start with Babes in Toyland's Spanking Machine from 1990. That record was pure chaos in the best way. It's abrasive, it's primal, and it feels like it's teetering on the edge of collapse the whole time, but that's what makes it brilliant.
Exactly. Tracks like Dust Cake Boy. Those jagged riffs and Cat Bjelland's voice, flipping between a childlike lilt and a guttural scream. It's unsettling and hypnotic at the same time. That vocal unpredictability became a hallmark for a lot of women in the scene.
And then there's L7's Bricks Are Heavy from 92. Donita Sparks and Susie Gardner turned the volume up and refused to apologize for it. Pretend We're Dead may have been their most radio-friendly track, but even that had this sly, sarcastic bite under the surface.
Right, and the rest of that album is just relentless. Shove is still one of the dirtiest, most infectious riffs of the era, and they didn't shy away from humor, even if it was dark, even if it made some listeners uncomfortable. That willingness to mix ferocity with wit was unique.
Another essential one is Viva Zapata by 7 Year Bitch. Released in 94 after the tragic death of guitarist Stephanie Sargent and in tribute to Mia Zapata, it's heavy in every sense, emotionally, lyrically, musically. Songs like Hip, Like Junk are pure fury. But there's also this undercurrent of resilience and solidarity.
Yeah, that record isn't just music. It's a document of grief turned into power. You can hear them processing loss in real time, but also refusing to be silenced. That's part of the female grunge DNA. Turning pain into something loud enough for the world to hear.
And then there's Holes Live Through This from 94. Courtney Love is polarizing, sure. But musically, that album is a masterclass in dynamics. Violet starts almost sweet, then detonates into rage. Doll Parts is tender and bitter, all at once. It's grunge, but it's also deeply personal poetry set to distortion.
And sonically, it's tighter than a lot of people give it credit for. Eric Erlandson's guitar work, paired with Love's vocal delivery, created something volatile but precise. And lyrically, it didn't hide behind metaphor unless it wanted to. It could be blunt, accusatory, and heartbreakingly open, sometimes in the same verse.
We also have to mention the Gits Enter, the Conquering Chicken from 93. Mia Zapata's voice had this bluesy depth that set her apart from the more punk-influenced vocals around her. A track like Second Skin is haunting. You feel every word in your chest.
And musically, that album blends grit with groove. The bass lines drive the songs just as much as the guitars do, which was something a lot of women-led bands leaned into. It gave their sound a different center of gravity compared to the more guitar-dominant male bands.
Speaking of bass, Jennifer Finch from L7 and Celine Vigil Wilk from 7 Year Bitch both understood how to make the bass a weapon, not just a background element. Those lines were melodic, but also had this weight that made the whole track hit harder.
And you could hear that influence later on in bands like Veruca Salt, even though they were more alt-rock than pure grunge. The low-end presence, the vocal interplay, you can trace it right back to those female pioneers in the early 90s.
It's also worth pointing out that a lot of these landmark records weren't recorded under glamorous conditions. Spanking Machine was done in just a few days. Viva Zapata had this urgency because it was made in the middle of intense personal upheaval. That rawness translated directly into the sound.
And in grunge, that rawness wasn't a flaw. It was a feature. You didn't clean up every imperfection. You leaned into them. The crack in the voice, the feedback squeal, the moment the snare mic distorts, those became part of the emotional punch.
Exactly, and that's why these albums still feel alive when you put them on today. They're not relics, they're conversations happening in real time, just recorded on tape. That immediacy is rare in modern production, where everything gets polished to perfection.
And I think that's why modern listeners, especially young women picking up instruments, connect so strongly with these records. They say, if they could make something that raw and have it resonate worldwide, maybe I don't have to wait until I'm ready. Maybe I can start now.
That's the legacy of these landmark works. They didn't just sound revolutionary in their time. They're still sparking revolutions now. And that's the real power of music, especially when it comes from artists who had to fight to be heard in the first place.
So one thing that really stands out to me about female grunge artists is how they weren't afraid to break the mold. Even within a genre known for rebellion, they were pushing the boundaries in ways that sometimes went unnoticed at the time.
Yeah, grunge had this reputation for being just loud guitars and flannel, but if you listen closely, some of the most innovative, genre-blending moments came from women in the scene. They were pulling in punk energy, blues phrasing, even folk storytelling, and sometimes in the same album.
Take Kat Bjelland again. Sure, Babes in Toyland were heavy and chaotic, but you can hear a twisted nursery rhyme quality in some of her melodies. That surreal edge didn't come from the typical rock playbook. It's why their songs feel so unpredictable, almost like they're teetering between menace and innocence.
And then there were bands experimenting with tempo and structure in ways that didn't always fit the grunge template. Some tracks started with slow, almost bluesy intros before detonating into noise rock fury. Others would skip traditional choruses entirely, just verse after verse of building tension until it snapped.
Another great example is L7. People remember them for the sheer volume. But they had tracks with funk-inspired bass grooves buried under all that distortion. Jennifer Finch could lock into a riff that almost made you want to dance. Right before the guitars crashed back in to remind you, this was still very much rock territory.
Yeah, and that kind of cross-pollination didn't happen in a vacuum. These women were listening to everything, punk, hardcore, blues, riot girl bands, classic rock, even pop. And they weren't shy about letting those influences bleed into their work. That's part of what kept female grunge from ever being one-dimensional.
And then there were the collaborations. Some of my favorite moments came when women from the grunge scene teamed up with artists from outside it, like guest vocals on punk records, or playing benefit gigs with Riot Girl bands from Olympia. It wasn't about genre purity, it was about shared energy and purpose.
Exactly. And sometimes the experiments were about instrumentation. Sure, distorted guitars were the core, but you'd get songs with unexpected acoustic sections, tambourines, or even violins. It was rare, but when it happened, it added this eerie beauty that cut through the heaviness.
I remember a bootleg of an acoustic set by Hole, where Courtney Love stripped the songs down to just voice and guitar. Without the wall of sound, you could hear the bones of the songwriting, the folk-like chord progressions, the lyrical cadence. It proved those songs could stand on their own without distortion to hide behind.
And that's where you see the real artistry, because grunge wasn't about technical perfection, but a lot of these women were way more musically versatile than they got credit for. They could pivot from a screaming wall of sound to something hauntingly quiet and make both feel authentic.
And the lyrics, this is another space where experimentation thrived. Some artists leaned into storytelling, pulling in characters and narratives that felt almost literary. Others embraced surreal, dreamlike imagery. And some went for pure stream-of-consciousness rants, letting the emotion shape the words in real time.
Mia Zapata was a master at that. She could write a song that felt like a short story, each verse painting a scene, while still keeping the raw edge of grunge intact. That's a skill a lot of songwriters in any genre would envy.
And it's interesting when you step back and look at it. The experimental side of female grunge wasn't about breaking away from grunge. It was about expanding it, proving that the genre could handle far more range and texture than the media stereotype allowed.
Exactly, and that's one of the reasons the influence has lasted. The male bands of the era were often boxed in by their own image. Heavy riffs, angsty lyrics, that's it. But the women kept opening doors. Slower tempos, unexpected harmonies, even humor in the middle of rage-filled songs.
And I think that's why when younger bands look back at grunge now, they often cite the women as their biggest inspiration. Not just because they were trailblazers in a male-dominated scene, but because musically they showed that you could mix vulnerability with aggression, melody with chaos, beauty with abrasion, and still make it feel cohesive.
It's a reminder that revolution in music isn't always about starting from scratch. Sometimes it's about taking what's already there and twisting it into shapes nobody saw coming. And that's exactly what these women did with grunge.
So, we've talked about the sound, the influence, the innovation, but we can't skip the reality check. Being a woman in the grunge scene, especially in the late 80s and early 90s, wasn't just about making music. It meant fighting battles on and off stage.
Yeah, and those battles started before you even plugged in your guitar. You'd walk into a venue and people would assume you were someone's girlfriend, a merch seller, maybe a roadie. Anything but the musician they'd come to hear. And it wasn't subtle. You could feel the skepticism before you even played a note.
And the irony was, the second they hit that first chord or scream, the room would shift. But having to prove yourself every single night takes a toll. Guys in all male bands didn't have to go through that same. Earn the right to be here, dance over and over again.
And it wasn't just the audience. Some sound engineers would literally question if you knew how to set up your own gear. I've heard stories of women showing up for sound check and being told, "Let me adjust that for you," before they'd even asked for help. It was condescending and it happened all the time.
And yet, that pushback almost became fuel. It made a lot of these women even more determined to own the stage, to make sure no one could doubt they belonged there. That fire is part of what made their performances so electric.
Yeah, but the fire came with exhaustion. Touring was brutal. Long van rides, sleeping on floors, eating whatever cheap food you could find. And then stepping on stage and giving everything you had night after night. There's a kind of glamour people imagine with touring, but for most grunge bands, it was survival mode.
And you couldn't just be the artist. You were also your own roadie, your own manager half the time, loading heavy amps into venues at 3 a.m., fixing a busted guitar strap with duct tape, figuring out where you were sleeping after the gig. That DIY grind never really stopped, even when some bands got bigger.
And then there was the media. If you were a woman in grunge, interviews could be infuriating. Instead of asking about your songwriting process or the recording sessions, they'd want to know what it was like being a girl in a man's world or comment on your looks. Some journalists didn't even realize how patronizing that was.
Yeah, I've read interviews from back then where the questions were basically coded ways of asking, so how do you fit into the boys' club? And the artists had to walk this line. Do you call it out and risk being labeled difficult, or do you just redirect the conversation back to the music?
A lot of them chose to call it out. And when they did, they inspired others to do the same. That's part of how these little solidarity networks formed. Women in different bands would look out for each other on the road, sharing contacts, offering a place to crash, warning about shady promoters.
And those networks weren't just about safety. They were about survival in the industry. If a label tried to mess with one band, word would spread fast. If a venue was disrespectful, other women knew to avoid it. That kind of grassroots information sharing kept a lot of bands from getting steamrolled.
And let's be honest, the sexism wasn't always subtle. There were hecklers, creepy fans, and even other musicians who thought they were entitled to comment on your body or tell you how to perform. It's a miracle some of these women didn't just walk away from music altogether.
But maybe that's part of why the music hit so hard. When you've been underestimated or dismissed, every loud, distorted chord is a kind of payback. It's like saying, "I'm still here, and you're going to hear me whether you like it or not."
And the thing is, the fight wasn't just for themselves. It was for the women in the crowd, too. Because if you saw someone like you on stage, owning it, it cracked something open. It made you realize there was space for you in that world, even if the gatekeeper said otherwise.
And that's where the social change part really comes in. Grunge, for all its flaws, gave a platform to voices that had been sidelined in rock. And the women in the scene used that platform to talk about things mainstream music often ignored: assault, sexism, mental health, economic struggle.
They weren't just singing about heartbreak or vague rebellion. They were naming names, telling their own stories, refusing to gloss over ugly truths. And that honesty made their music more than entertainment. It made it a lifeline for listeners going through similar struggles.
And it's wild to think about how much of that influence carries forward today. You can hear it in modern punk, indie, and alt-rock bands led by women. The grit, the vulnerability, the refusal to shrink yourself to fit someone else's idea of a frontwoman, that's straight from this era.
Exactly. And that's why, even though the industry has changed, the lessons from those years are still relevant. Women in music still deal with sexism, but they also have these battle-tested examples of how to push back, how to survive, and how to thrive without losing themselves.
So we've talked about the day-to-day grind and the sexism they faced, but there's another layer here. A lot of these women weren't just making music, they were activists. They used their platform to push for real change.
Yeah, and it wasn't activism in a polished, PR-friendly way. It was raw, grassroots, sometimes risky. You'd see bands playing benefit shows for women's shelters, LGBTQ plus rights groups, or organizations fighting against sexual violence. And this wasn't a side project, it was woven into their identity as artists.
One of the most powerful examples was how the community responded to Mia Zapata's murder in 93. Bands like 7 Year Bitch and Nirvana helped raise money for self-defense classes and awareness campaigns. It turned grief into action, and it showed how tightly knit that scene was.
Right. And it wasn't just memorial events. It sparked a long-term movement around safety for women in music spaces. That sense of solidarity became a model for other scenes. And it was often the women leading those conversations, making sure it didn't just fade from memory after a few weeks.
And protest songs were a huge part of it. Some were blunt and direct, naming the problem without sugarcoating it. Others were more metaphorical, but still packed with fury. Either way, they were rallying cries for anyone who'd felt marginalized or silenced.
Yeah, take 7 Year Bitch's The Scratch. It's not subtle. It's a snarling indictment of exploitation and violence. And the delivery is so intense that even if you didn't know every lyric, you'd feel the rage in every beat.
And L7 had Wargasm, a biting political track disguised in a driving, almost anthemic groove. It's the kind of song that gets people shouting along without realizing they're chanting an anti-war message at the top of their lungs.
Holes Asking For It tackled the issue of consent and victim blaming in a way that was deeply uncomfortable for some listeners, and that was the point. It forced people to confront the casual cruelty in how society talks about assault.
And they didn't just stop with the songs. These women showed up at protests, spoke out in interviews, and used zines and liner notes to share information about everything from reproductive rights to anti-censorship campaigns. They were building cultural resistance as much as they were making records.
And remember, this was pre-social media. You couldn't just post a link or a hashtag. If you wanted people to know about a cause, you handed out flyers at shows, you talked about it on stage, you made space in your set for the message. That face-to-face activism was personal and powerful.
And sometimes they caught backlash for it. There were critics who rolled their eyes and said, just play the music. But grunge was never just about the music, it was about the message. And the women especially weren't going to waste their microphone time playing it safe.
Exactly, and I think it's worth noting how intersectional some of their activism was. They weren't only talking about sexism, they were also standing with queer communities, with people of color, with working class struggles. They understood that oppression wasn't just one thing, and their music reflected that complexity.
It's funny, or maybe sad, that a lot of those same issues are still on the table today, which is why revisiting these songs now feels urgent, not just nostalgic. They were documenting a fight that hasn't ended.
And that's why their legacy isn't just musical. It's cultural. They built a template for how to be an artist and an activist at the same time, without letting either side get watered down. And that's not easy to do, especially when you're facing industry pressure to just entertain.
And they did it while living the same exhausting, chaotic lives we talked about earlier. Long tours, low pay, constant travel. Activism wasn't some side gig for them. It was part of the fabric of their careers.
And the fans felt that. When you went to a show, you weren't just hearing songs. You were joining a conversation, sometimes a protest, sometimes a collective grieving. It was music as community action. And that's what made it so powerful.
If there's one thing that really sticks out when you hear stories from women in the grunge scene, it's how much of their survival depended on sisterhood, especially on the road. Touring wasn't glamorous. It was a grind. And having each other's backs was essential.
Yeah. The road could be unpredictable and sometimes dangerous. You might play to a packed, welcoming crowd one night, and the next be in some tiny club where the vibe was, let's just say, hostile. Having other women in the scene to lean on made a huge difference in how you handled those nights.
And it wasn't just about watching out for creeps in the crowd, though that was definitely part of it. It was about helping each other stay sane, sharing gear when something broke, pooling money for food, even just swapping stories in the van to keep spirits up after a rough gig.
Some bands even coordinated tour schedules so they could cross paths and crash at each other's places. Imagine driving 12 hours after a show, completely wiped. And instead of sleeping on a stranger's floor, you walk into a friend's apartment where there's a hot meal and a couch waiting for you. That kind of care was priceless.
And it wasn't just bands helping bands. The fans played a huge role too. Women in the audience would sometimes band together to keep each other safe during shows, especially in rowdier crowds. That mutual protection became an unspoken code in certain venues.
Right, and that sense of safety made the shows better for everyone. When women in the crowd felt they could stand up front without worrying about being shoved or harassed, the whole energy shifted. It became more about connection than competition for space.
And a lot of artists actively encouraged that. I've read about front women stopping a set to call out someone being aggressive in the pit or telling security to remove them. That was a big deal back then. It sent a message that you were responsible for the vibe in your own space.
It also extended backstage. Sometimes venues didn't even have proper dressing rooms, so bands would claim a little corner and create a safe zone with blankets, gear cases, whatever they had. It was a way of saying, this is ours and we're going to keep it that way.
And those improvised safe spaces weren't just about physical safety, they were mental recharge zones. A place to decompress, laugh about the chaos, maybe even write new songs in between sets. I think that kind of intimacy is part of why so many collaborations happened in this era.
Totally. You'd be in some random city, sitting on the floor with another band, trading riffs and lyric ideas, and suddenly you've got a new song. That spontaneity was part of the magic, and it only happened because people felt comfortable and supported in those moments.
And that support system wasn't just emotional, it was practical. If a van broke down, other bands would help get the stranded musicians to their next gig. If someone got sick, there was usually another musician ready to step in and cover parts so the show could go on.
It's that we're all in this together mentality. The industry wasn't going to roll out a safety net for women in grunge, so they built one themselves. And that solidarity became part of the culture, not just for touring, but for the whole scene.
And I think fans could feel that solidarity even if they weren't aware of all the behind-the-scenes stuff. You could sense when a band was part of a community instead of just out for themselves. That vibe drew people in. It made them want to be part of it, too.
And that's how you got these pockets of, say, vibrant music culture, even in the middle of a pretty rough and tumble rock scene. It wasn't perfect. Nothing is. But for a lot of people, it was the first time they felt truly welcome in that kind of space.
And that welcome extended long after the shows ended. Friendships formed on those tours that still exist decades later. People who once swapped floor space in cramped apartments are still swapping music recommendations or showing up for each other's projects today.
That's the thing. The sisterhood of female grunge wasn't just a survival tactic. It was a legacy. It proved you could make your own rules, protect each other, and still create something loud, messy, and unforgettable. And that's a blueprint that still inspires bands now.
One thing I love about revisiting this era is seeing how female grunge seeped into the wider culture, sometimes intentionally, sometimes by accident. It wasn't just music. It was a look, an attitude, a whole aesthetic that made its way into fashion, film, and even mainstream TV.
Yeah, and the irony is that aesthetic started as pure practicality. Oversized flannel shirts, ripped jeans, boots. It wasn't a fashion statement for the women in the scene. It was about staying warm in rainy Seattle, wearing stuff you could actually play in, and not spending money you didn't have.
Exactly. And then suddenly, you had high-end designers putting flannel on runways and charging hundreds of dollars for what used to be a thrift store find. It was weird watching something born from DIY thrift culture become a trend in glossy magazines.
And for a lot of the women in grunge, that commodification felt off. because the style was tied to an attitude of not caring about style in the first place. But at the same time, some of them used that attention to their advantage. If Vogue wanted to interview you, you could sneak in a few pointed comments about the realities of the scene.
And it wasn't just clothes. The music itself crossed over into movies and TV. You'd hear female-fronted grunge songs on soundtracks for films like Tank Girl or Foxfire, where the vibe matched that rebellious energy perfectly. Those soundtracks introduced a lot of young listeners to bands they might never have found otherwise.
And Tank Girl is a perfect example. The whole movie was dripping with that punk-grunge hybrid spirit, and the soundtrack was stacked with female voices. It was like a cultural handshake between underground music and alternative cinema.
TV picked up on it too, even if sometimes it was just using the look. You'd have characters in teen dramas suddenly dressing in ripped tights and combat boots because it was edgy, even if the show's writing didn't capture the actual spirit behind it.
Right, and that's where the mainstream often missed the mark. They grabbed the visuals, but not the substance. But there were still moments where the crossover felt genuine, like when bands got to perform live on shows or late-night TV, bringing the real energy to a wider audience.
And beyond entertainment, you saw female grunge influencing visual art and photography. Those black and white, high contrast band portraits, gritty, unposed, sometimes mid-scream, became iconic. They broke away from the polished promo shots of the 80s and set a new tone for how rock could be presented.
Yeah, and that authenticity carried into zine culture too. Women in the scene were making their own zines with gig photos, interviews, manifestos, and collages. Those zines were as much a part of the visual language of grunge as the music videos were.
And speaking of videos, MTV may have sometimes sanitized the edges of grunge, but some female-led videos still slipped through with all their grit intact. L7's Shove video, for instance, it wasn't stylized glamour. It was sweaty, loud, and unapologetically real.
Exactly. And those moments gave younger audiences something different to latch onto. Something that felt more honest than the air-rushed pop dominating at the time. You could see yourself in those bands in a way that wasn't about fantasy, but about possibility.
And then there's the crossover with other music genres. Some female grunge musicians collaborated with punk bands, Riot Girl groups, even hip-hop artists on spoken word or soundtrack projects. That willingness to blur lines kept the scene from becoming a closed bubble.
And it wasn't always about formal collaborations. Sometimes it was just shared bills at festivals. You'd have a grunge band sharing the stage with an industrial act or a folk punk singer-songwriter, and the audience would be exposed to something they didn't expect to like. That openness expanded the reach of female grunge without diluting it.
And you can't ignore how that openness shaped mainstream perceptions of women in rock. Before this era, the stereotype was still that women in bands were either the token member or the pretty front woman. Female grunge smashed that idea. You could be intense, political, messy, and still command a crowd.
And that's why even when the mainstream got the surface wrong, the core message seeped through. Somewhere, some kid watching MTV at midnight was seeing a woman screaming into a mic and thinking, "I didn't know you were allowed to do that." That's the real crossover influence. The spark it lit in people who'd never set foot in a Seattle club.
One of the biggest cultural exports of grunge, and especially female grunge, was the style. But here's the thing. For the women in the scene, it wasn't about looking cool. It was about survival, comfort, and not buying into the beauty standards the industry kept trying to sell them.
Exactly. The ripped tights, thrift store dresses, combat boots, those weren't costumes. That was literally what you could afford, what you could play in, and what felt like you. And in a way, it was a rejection of the hyper-styled, hyper-feminine image women in music had been pushed into for decades.
And yet, within a few years, that rejection became a trend. Suddenly, you had fashion spreads calling it grunge chic and selling distressed clothing for hundreds of dollars. It was bizarre. The whole point was that it wasn't about money or fashion. And then the mainstream flipped it into exactly that.
Yeah, and a lot of the women in the scene hated that. Because now you had people walking around in perfectly curated, messy outfits, while the musicians who inspired it were still scraping together gas money to make it to the next gig, the disconnect was wild.
And the media leaned into it hard. They'd take a photo of someone like Courtney Love in a ripped slip dress and caption it as a style guide, ignoring the fact that she was making a statement about how women were perceived, not starting a fashion trend.
Courtney's whole Kinderwhore look was a perfect example. It was deliberately jarring, mixing doll-like dresses with smeared makeup and an aggressive stage presence. It was meant to make people uncomfortable, to force them to question why we associate femininity with weakness. But the fashion industry just saw it as another look to sell.
And it wasn't just Courtney. Kat Bieland, Donita Sparks, Jennifer Finch, they all had this way of dressing that came from personality and practicality. But once the cameras started rolling, magazines started treating them like style icons, as if the outfits were more important than the music.
And that's a tricky space to navigate, because on one hand, visibility can be powerful. If a teenage girl sees you on the cover of a magazine, it might plant a seed that she can be a musician too. But on the other hand, when the press focuses on your skirt instead of your set list, it's frustrating as hell.
And I think that's why so many female grunge artists played with irony in their image. They'd take the photo shoot, but they'd show up unshaven with chipped nail polish or with a t-shirt that said something deliberately provocative. It was a way to take back control of the narrative, even if they had to step into the spotlight to do it.
Yeah, like L7's infamous moment at Reading Festival where they mooned the crowd. That wasn't just shock value. It was flipping the script on objectification, saying, you want to treat us like bodies first? Fine, here's a body. Now let's get back to the music.
And that kind of defiance kept them from being fully co-opted. Sure, the mainstream borrowed the surface, but the deeper meaning stayed intact for the people who were paying attention. The rebellion was still there, even if it was hidden under a layer of cultural misunderstanding.
And that's the thing, symbols get messy once they leave their original context. A ripped dress on a stage in Seattle means one thing. The same dress in a fashion spread means something else entirely. The women in grunge had to constantly fight to keep their symbols from being drained of meaning.
And yet, they couldn't control everything. Once the mainstream decides something is cool, it spreads whether you like it or not. But maybe that's the paradox. Even if the meaning gets diluted, the fact that those images reached so many people meant the seed of the original intent might still sprout somewhere unexpected.
Right. Some kid in a small town might pick up a magazine for the fashion, but end up looking up the band, hearing the lyrics, and getting the real message. So even through the commodification, there's still a chance for the truth to sneak through.
One thing that doesn't get talked about enough is just how far female grunge influence traveled. Not just across the US, but internationally. And a lot of that happened through unexpected collaborations and soundtrack work.
Yeah, because grunge might have been rooted in Seattle, but those voices carried way beyond it. You had female-fronted grunge bands ending up on film soundtracks that played in theaters all over the world, introducing people to that sound who might never have bought a Sub Pop record otherwise.
Exactly, like L7 showing up on the Natural Born Killers soundtrack. That movie was controversial and intense. And their music fit the chaos perfectly. It wasn't just background, it was part of the film's attitude.
And Hole's credit in the Straight World cover making it into The Crow. City of Angels soundtrack, again, that dark, atmospheric edge carried the spirit of grunge into a whole different audience. It was almost like these songs became cultural ambassadors for a mood, not just a genre.
Then there were the collaborations. Some women in the scene worked with punk bands, others with indie folk artists. You'd even find them guesting on industrial or noise rock projects. It wasn't about staying in one lane. It was about finding the same raw energy in other styles and building something new together.
And that's where grunge's crossover potential really shone, because it was always more of an attitude than a strict musical formula. A grunge frontwoman could step into a hardcore punk track or a slow, moody alt-country song and still sound completely authentic.
Plus, festivals became these melting pots. Bands from Seattle or Minneapolis would end up on the same bill as groups from the UK, Japan, or Australia. And those international acts took pieces of that female grunge energy home with them, weaving it into their own scenes.
Exactly. You started to hear traces of it in Japanese noise rock, in UK riot, GRRL-influenced punk, even in some European metal bands that suddenly leaned into fuzzier, sludgier tones. That cross-pollination was real, and it went both ways. US grunge bands picked up tricks and influences from abroad too.
And sometimes the collaborations weren't musical at all. Female grunge artists got involved in art installations, photography projects, even spoken word albums. It was like once you broke out of the narrow box the industry put you in, you realized you could spill into any creative medium you wanted.
And because their credibility came from authenticity, those crossovers didn't feel like gimmicks. They felt like extensions of the same voice, whether that voice was screaming over feedback or reading poetry over an ambient track.
And we can't forget about TV and commercials, not in a sellout way, but in the sense that suddenly this sound was everywhere. A riff from a female-led grunge track might show up in a skateboarding video or a sports highlight reel. It wasn't always credited, but the influence was there.
And that's the funny thing about influence. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's sneaky. You might not even realize the bass line in that 2000s indie hit Ozodette to a 1993 grunge track, but it's in the DNA. It's like a musical accent that got passed down.
And even today, you see new artists citing these women as inspirations, not just for their sound, but for their fearlessness in crossing boundaries. They made it okay to be messy, loud, experimental, and still be taken seriously as a musician.
And that's the ultimate crossover influence, not the flannel or the distortion, but the freedom to take up space however you want. That's the part that traveled the farthest, and it's still landing in new places decades later.
So here we are, decades after the so-called end of grunge. And yet, the fingerprints of those female pioneers are everywhere. It's wild how something the media once called a fad turned into a permanent part of rock's DNA.
Yeah, because even if the exact sound of early 90 seconds grunge isn't dominating the charts, its spirit, especially the part women brought to it, is alive in so many current bands. You hear it in the raw vocals of indie rock singers, in the sludgy guitar tones in alt metal, even in some singer-songwriters who push vulnerability to the front.
And it's not just the sound. The whole attitude, the refusal to be polished for the sake of marketability, the idea that you can lead with authenticity over perfection, that's straight from the grunge playbook. And women were crucial in making that a norm rather than an exception.
Look at someone like St. Vincent or Mitski, totally different genres. But they both share that sense of taking control of their image and sound, not letting the industry define them. That's a direct echo of what women in grunge were doing back in the day.
Same with bands like Warpaint or Bully. They're modern acts, but they're carrying that same blend of grit and melody, heavy dynamics, and a lyrical openness that would have fit right into the early 90s scene. The torch has definitely been passed, even if the genre labels have shifted.
And then there's the way modern artists talk about activism, the fact that so many young musicians see speaking out on social issues as part of their job. That's in part because they grew up with examples of women in grunge who made activism inseparable from their art.
Totally. That connection between music and community responsibility didn't start in the 90s, but grunge and the women in it made it visible in whole new way. And now you've got that ethos woven into punk, indie folk, even mainstream pop.
What's exciting is seeing how the influence keeps morphing. The next 10 to 20 years won't just be about recreating the old sound. It's about taking that foundation of honesty and rebellion and building new structures on top of it. Maybe with more electronics, maybe with global influences that weren't in the Seattle scene originally.
And more diversity too. Back in the grunge days, it was still a pretty white Pacific Northwest-centric scene. The future could see that same DIY, raw rock energy coming from way more backgrounds and perspectives, which will only make it richer.
Exactly, and I think that's the real legacy, not just a set of songs or outfits, but a blueprint for how to create without permission, how to build community, how to be loud in every sense of the word. That's timeless, and it's going to outlive every trend.
When I think about the legacy of female grunge, I see it less as a chapter that closed in the 90s and more as a fuse that's still burning. It keeps setting off sparks in new genres, in new scenes, in artists who might not even realize they're carrying the torch.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. Influence doesn't have to be conscious to be real. A teenage guitarist in Brazil, a bedroom producer in South Korea, a punk singer in Nairobi, they might never have been to Seattle. But if they value honesty over perfection, if they build their music from lived experience, they're part of that lineage.
And you can already hear the echoes in newer waves of rock. It's in the unapologetic lyrics, in the willingness to be messy on stage, in the rejection of being neatly packaged for consumption. That's pure grunge spirit, and it's often the women leading that charge now, just like they did then.
What I hope for the next 10 to 20 years is even more genre cross-pollination. Imagine grunge grit mixing with modern punk, with heavy electronica, with traditional folk instruments from places it's never touched before. Female grunge was never about staying in a box, and the future shouldn't be either.
And I think the technology we have now makes that inevitable. Back in the day, recording an album meant scraping together studio money and praying a label would notice you. Now, an artist with a laptop can record, release, and connect with listeners worldwide in days. That's going to supercharge the kind of fearless experimentation grunge always thrived on.
And hopefully we'll also see the next generation keep pushing for equity in the industry. Because if there's one thing the women of the 90s showed us, it's that the fight for space on the stage isn't just about you. It's about making it easier for whoever comes next.
Exactly. And that's the thread that ties the pioneers to the future community. Whether it was a basement gig in 89 or a live stream in 2035, it's about creating a space where people feel seen, heard, and empowered to make noise, literal or metaphorical.
And for the listeners out there, whether you've been with grunge since the first distorted chord rang out or you're just discovering it, remember that this isn't just history. It's a living, breathing energy you can still tap into, still add to, still pass on.
So dig into those old records, but also keep your ears open for the new voices carrying that torch. Support them. Share their music, go to their shows, because that's how the fuse keeps burning and how the next explosion of creativity will happen.
And who knows? Maybe some of you listening right now will be the ones lighting that fire in the future. All it takes is a riff, a lyric, and the guts to be exactly who you are, no matter who's watching.
And with that, we're wrapping up today's deep dive into the world of female grunge artists. It's been a loud, raw, and beautiful journey through the rain-soaked streets of Seattle and far beyond.
Thanks for joining us, for feeling this music with us, and for keeping the spirit alive in your own way. Wherever you are, keep playing loud, living honestly, and building your own space, because that's what they taught us.
We'll see you next time here on Melody Mind. Until then, stay true, stay loud, and never let anyone tell you your voice doesn't belong on the stage.